ancestor's eyes. A warrior sat on the earth with a smile. The rays reflected his frame, shadowing his profile. I was prepared to share my life with his mind and ability. The forest, plains, fires, all structured in community. The rules to raise a family traditionally. Now in 2004, what remains are the traces of that history. Blind as his compliments and commitments to me rolled off his tongue. My perfection was the foundation of his words. I was the one. His past was filled with loneliness and misery. Years of violence and neglect plague his memory. Drunken lessons formed his life. Knowledge of broken branches in a tree of questions. I asked, he would confess them. He believed and I believe we were above it. Forgot the past, he was safe with me and I loved it. But it leaked out a little as the pain came in trickles. I was caught in the middle of his pride and his riddles. He couldn't figure out, shot him with a shout. And I tried to understand as he pushed me to get them out. I was quick to recoup, I took the falls, finding nice posters for the holes in the walls. Too sick to stop the cycle, hammer this nail into my head. Living in the cost of a culture lost, some say I'm better off dead. Too sick to stop the cycle, hammer this nail into my head. Living in the cost of a culture lost, some say I'm better off dead. Better off dead.
And welcome back to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby. I am one of your hosts today, Peter Driftmeyer, and I'm joined in the studio by Maria Parshtadter.
Hi, Peter.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. So we were on the air 2 weeks ago for this noon hour mishmash of public affairs and social justice programming. Then we had no name, and now we're flirting with the idea of the name Worm's Eye View News from the Grassroots. Well, we'd really like to hear what you have to think about that name. And if you want to let us know after the show, you can reach us in the studio at 778-782-4423.
Right. So, on today's show, we're going to bring you, first of all, an interview, a live interview, with Cynthia Oka, who is an activist based here in Vancouver. She recently attended the U.S. Social Forum in Detroit and is going to share about her experience there. In the second half of our hour, we will bring you a selection of stories from the police crackdown in Toronto, something that's been on my mind a lot. And if you listen to Democracy Now! Earlier on our channel, you heard that 600 to 800 people were arrested this weekend. So we're going to hear from some of them. And as well, we're bringing you a selection of Canadian music that celebrates the spirit of resistance.
That's right. And we're going to continue with that with the hip-hop group Equal. The track is Too Sick.
One for the road, so we dabbled with the drink. Said he needed to relax, didn't always want to think. I'll admit, I was part of it. It made him happy, brought us closer. Besides, I'm not as pretty or as confident a person when I'm sober. Plus, my connections in the world threatened him. Didn't trust guys, said they're all into the medicine. But the parties were full up, the types he despised. Saw the negative attention when he looked into my eyes. I guess I presented it to everyone, my slutty intentions, and I sure as hell pay for it. Seconds after it was mentioned, the glass hit my lip, felt the floor as I slipped. Three or four, try to loosen his grip. My love's eyes burned like molten lava poured into me. Then I saw the recognition on his face of my injuries. Tears of apologies spilling, joined me on the floor. He was just trying to have a good time. I had to wreck it. He lifted me up, and then a bottle said, take a sip. But it was difficult to drink with a fat lip. Cycle hammer this nail into my head. Living in the cost of a culture lost. Some say I'm better off dead. Too sick to stop the cycle hammer this nail into my head. Living in the cost of a culture lost. Some say I'm better off dead. Man, wake up. You're dreaming of the past when you were wanted, needed a role in the cast. A winter morning cool clean when the hunt's at its best. You had no arrows, took a knife and stabbed your girl in the chest. No family to bring her home to as they're already at rest. Carried on the tradition of alcohol and violence. The city stripped you clean of your conscious hopes and dreams. The pen walls continue to remind you every girl screams. It was love, no doubt, but how you do it burned out. Long ago when you should have stopped the cycle from carrying through. Now the sun we you
just like a hammer, this nail into my head. Living in the cost of a culture lost. Some say I'm better off dead. Too sick to stop the cycle, hammer this nail into my head. Living in the cost of a culture lost. Some say I'm better off dead. Better off dead. Too sick to stop the cycle, hammer this nail into my head. Living in the cost of a culture lost. Some say I'm better off dead. Better off dead.
The second ever U.S. Social Forum came to a close a few days ago, bringing 20,000 people from across the United States to Detroit, Michigan. Under the slogan, Another World is Possible, Another U.S. is Necessary, social movements, environmental organizations, and organized labor came together for 5 days, with workshops, panel discussions, focus topic assemblies, and arts and culture. Participants discussed the impacts of capitalist economic policy on their communities and how to build a better United States from the left. Cynthia Oka joins us by phone to report back from Detroit. Cynthia is a community organizer with the Vancouver Status of Women and was one of the few Canadians in attendance. Hello, Cynthia.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Good. You slept up a bit and caught some rest?
Yeah, just a bit.
Right on. Can you describe for us what the social forum looked like on the ground?
On the ground, I mean, there were a lot of people. I think they had over 20,000 registrants. I believe it was 22,000 people registered for the forum. And in terms of the people actually there, I believe it was like 15,000 to 18,000 people attending. So there were a lot of people. Lots of things going on every day. It was 4 days, very packed. There were over 1,000 workshops being held. There were 54 people's movement assemblies. There were a number of plenaries. There were evening arts and culture shows. Lots of local MCs, artists, poets in attendance. There was also the Children's Social Forum where 100 kids were there for over the 4 days. It was held in downtown Detroit at a large hall there called Cobo Hall. It was really big, and a lot of the events was taking place at that hall and also at local universities all around.
Why did you choose to participate?
I chose to participate because, I think it's really important to be in conversation cross-border with organizers doing work in the United States because of how entwined the U.S. and Canadian economy and politics are. So I felt it was important to be there to offer solidarity, to find out what people were doing, and also possibly to network and to see what possibilities exist for cross-border coordination, because as we see, Canadian policy really moves in conversation with U.S. policy in terms of war, in terms of oil, in terms of the economy, in terms of security, intelligence, all of these things. Decision-making circles are definitely very much in bed with each other. So I think it was very important to be in conversation with folks and see, you know, what people were doing and what they needed, and also how they could support struggles in Canada. And I also have a lot of friends who are organizing in the States, so it was really good to see people.
And it's especially interesting because so many Canadians involved in the left who had the resources were going to Toronto at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, I think almost everyone else, except for two other organizers from Vancouver, ended up going to Toronto right after Detroit. So they just crossed the bridge.
Did they have any issues getting across?
I think so, yeah. All three of my friends who came with us have, you know, encountered a lot of police, a lot of securitization. So my friends were specifically, I mean, the cops were really on them all the time when they were at Toronto, and also when they were in Detroit. They had painted a large mural and were bringing it to the G20 to hang. And it was a painting about the tar sands. Their materials got confiscated in Toronto right before they came to Detroit. And since then, I've heard that they came back to Toronto after Detroit, and they weren't able to get that stuff back. So that's what's going on with that. And I also had my luggage pulled on the way back from the USSF. It's still sitting in Chicago.
Yeah. I imagine you weren't the only one.
Yeah.
And the other participants there, what sense did you get in terms of what they were trying to get from that experience?
I think people came for many different reasons. I think there were folks who, there were activists who came for the specific purpose of networking. There were other people who came just to kind of find out what issues were going on, like sort of newer activists. I think the most effective people at the forum were folks who had a very planned, they already had a strategy going into the social forum in terms of connecting with other groups and developing alliances and very specific priorities for the following, for the next couple of years. And there were those folks, and those folks came in large delegations. The National Domestic Workers Alliance is a good example of that. They really made full use of the forum in terms of bringing together, you know, excluded oppressed workers from all over, just in terms of organizers and speaking to each other and developing coordinated strategies.
Were there many people from Detroit itself?
There were folks from Detroit itself. There were many organizers, definitely from Detroit. The Bog Center was there. Young Detroit Builders were there. So, like, I mean, they really, they definitely represented themselves. It was, like, the first day was a full day of, like, various Detroit grassroots organizations showcasing their work. There are a lot of very, there are a lot of amazing alternatives being built in Detroit right now. It's very interesting. The city is empty. There's a lot of wealth sitting there, like in terms of really nice buildings, everything very well kept, and almost every other building like on lease or out for rent. So it's interesting to see how pretty kind of the devastation is. Like there is this devastation for sure, and once you get out of the core, you can sort of see more of the effects on the local neighborhoods. But people in Detroit have been have had to be very creative in terms of developing alternatives. Like urban agriculture is a really big thing there. People just taking over vacant lots and growing food for their communities, for instance. So yeah, there were definitely Detroit folks there. There were also folks who are just residents of Detroit that were there. I think though they were far outnumbered by how many activists from all over the states were there.
You mentioned that the city seemed really devastated. Like, what did it look like? Like,
it.
What does devastation in the big U.S. cities look like?
I think as I was mentioning earlier, it's the emptiness is really. It's like omnipresent. Like in the downtown core, for instance, there are no grocery stores. Like, we were just, like, shocked. We're like, how can there not be a grocery store? And it's very interesting. I mean, the suburbs, because we actually stayed in one suburb. The suburb seemed, I mean, kind of like any regular U.S. city. But the downtown core, it was very pronounced, sort of, what had happened there. If you were to go down a block, I mean, you're lucky to find two stores that are open. And at every single block, at least a few buildings were had signs putting it up for a lease that it was vacant. So that was very noticeable. There were a lot of police. There were a lot of cops. That was also noticeable. And in terms of poverty, just a lot of like just regular folks like on the streets, and it's very racialized. You know, that's very, very noticeable. Just in terms of who is being impacted is primarily, obviously, the black communities in Detroit around the poverty that's very noticeable on the ground.
Did that mark of who's impacted by the recession, was that present also in delegates from across the U.S.?
Yeah. I would say, I mean, I would say it's about 50-50, maybe 60-40. I don't know, maybe because I was paying more attention to the sort of people of color delegations. That's possible. But definitely lots of grassroots organizations from all over. The South was really well represented. Lots of organizations from, you know, North Carolina, from Atlanta, Georgia, from New Orleans. So there was a very strong representation, definitely, of people of color at the USSF.
And now it's still only a few days after the closing of the forum, so it's definitely hard to say what will come of it in the long run. But in what ways do you think the social forum accomplished those roles of movement building that it set out to?
I think it's a beautiful space for people to connect with each other. I think it's very special to be in community with all of these people who all identify as revolutionary, as activists, as radicals. I think definitely that was very beautiful. You get to meet people who are doing similar work and sort of talk about things. And I think that because of the structure of the social forum and how broad it was, there was just so many things going on, it was challenging to go deep into the work. So unless you were part of, like, unless you came in with a strategy, with a strong delegation, with already a plan, so that the USSF is part of your broader strategy around movement building, I think it supported movements in that way. Like, I can see it as a very strengthening space and strategic space for the National Domestic Workers Alliance, for instance.
How did groups like that make it work for them?
I think that they already had a strong base. They already had, like, a campaign going on. They were already in conversation with a lot of different organizations who are organizing and mobilizing excluded, marginalized workers. So then the U.S. Forum became a space for people to coordinate and to reflect and to support each other, people who are already doing the same work. And I think that there was, like, there was a balance of that at the USSF, with kind of more information sharing, where people were coming in to, like, learn about issues and to kind of meet people. So I think that overall it established a larger sense of community amongst people doing movement work, and I think that that's very valuable. And I personally think, and it's also because I'm coming as, like, you know, as a Canadian, as someone from Canada, but, like, I wasn't part of a large delegation or anything, and I wasn't coming with that kind of strategic perspective mm-hmm. into the space. So I think that for me, like, the thing that I got the most out of it was those connections with people. And I think it seems to me that that's a larger role that it served. There were, like, important resolutions that got passed. Definitely I do want to mention the Indigenous Peoples Movement Assembly, because they came out with, like, some really, really powerful, concrete demands and very assertive of, I mean, this is what we want, this is what we want people to do, these are our goals, our objectives, like, very... very strategic in that sense. So I think that was a great space for them in that sense. So kind of, like, build a base inside of the U.S. Social Forum. I think that's the primary role that it served for strengthening movements that already have kind of a direction to go. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. And the picture we've been painted so far shows a lot of discussion and dialogue and skill sharing. Were there any action-oriented components of it?
There were, and I think, again, because of the broad nature, I feel that from my perspective, there wasn't really, like, anything to hold people accountable to follow through. I think that's one. And secondly, it was As I was mentioning earlier, there wasn't enough time or space to kind of go really deep into something unless you were already part of like a delegation that was doing that work already. So I really noticed kind of there was a lot of information taking and a lot of conversation and less debate and decision making. So I think that would be something I look forward to experiencing more at the next U.S. Social Forum.
And from what you could see, how were the communities in Detroit benefiting from the Social Forum happening there?
I really want to honor the Detroit community because I think that they gave a lot more to movement people who came up to Detroit. They offered their city, they offered their spaces, and there were these tours that were organized to kind of show people what folks were doing. I wasn't actually able to go on a tour because I had my son with me. It was just too expensive. But there were these tours, and there were volunteer teams that got set up, so like you could sign up to volunteer with a specific Detroit project, like whether it was like painting a wall or doing some farming, and multiple other things. What? And I think that in that sense, actually, I think Detroit gave a lot to people who came. They gave inspiration. They gave ideas. There was a lot of energy. I think in terms of what folks came, from my perspective, I see it as more kind of like individuals connecting with specific projects in Detroit and less so of organizational commitments to doing building work in Detroit in connection with what they were doing in their respective cities.
Right.
Yeah.
And you mentioned your son was with you. What was he doing during this whole time?
He was at the Children's Social Forum.
What's the Children's Social Forum?
So the Children's Social Forum, there was actually some, like, a little bit of a lack of clarity when we got there about this, and there's been, I know that there's been some challenges. I also really wanted to honor the people who took on the child care work. And from my son, what I know is that, you know, they did really cool things, like they learned all about the history of Detroit. Like, Paul knows more about Detroit at this point than I do. He knows, like, the history of specific buildings there. They went on field trips. They did a lot of art together. So I think it was community building amongst the children of organizers, which is kind of cool in and of itself. And they were learning a lot. They were learning a lot about, they were talking about issues around gentrification and the movement of capital and things like that, in child language, I presume.
Yeah.
But Paul was, the other day, he was telling me about, you know, the history of particular buildings and what happened and why it's empty now and things like that. So there's a way, there's an intentionality in terms of translating it to the kids, what's happening in the world. So I think that was pretty cool.
Right on. Well, now, the first U.S. Social Forum occurred sometime after the World Social Forum had already been taking place for some time, right?
Yeah, it was in 2007, I believe.
And I think different provinces in Canada have had their own social forums, but how do you think this kind of convergence would translate to a kind of pan-Canadian social forum?
I think from my perspective, in terms of what I experienced in the USSF, I really do believe that there is a need for larger coordination amongst movements continentally, like across North America. And I mentioned this to, I mean, pretty much all the organizers that I spoke with at the social forum. It's like, you know, like, what do you guys think about having a North American social forum instead? Because we really can't stand apart from the fact that, yeah, that a lot of the decisions that are being made by governments by corporations are going across the borders. So I really think that we need to, from my perspective, I really think that we need to challenge, like, American-based organizers to look beyond their own borders, because there is definitely a trend to be, U.S.-centric, and they don't know a lot of what's going on in Canada. And I think that needs to change. Because, for instance, just one of the clearest examples is around, like, resolutions or items of action relating to Indigenous solidarity. I mean, these are communities and nations that transcend the imposed colonial borders. Like, how are you going to make resolutions solely for nations that are inside of, you know, inside the American nation-state entity? Like, it doesn't make sense, because that kind of just re-entrenches colonialism. So I really think that that's a very clear example of how these conversations need to transcend the Canadian-U.S. border, and it serves particular authorities for us to continue to do our work in separation from each other, and kind of like, well, that's going on for them. And this is not to take away from the fact that they're clearly different contexts. I mean, the United States, for instance, has like 50 states, right? And each state has specific things going on. That doesn't mean that people shouldn't formulate their visions and strategies in conversation with each other, because at the end of the day, it is precisely also these borders that we are trying to break down, right? So I think that, from my perspective, it's more useful to kind of broaden the U.S. social forum, because it's already organized, rather than kind of like restart the wheel in Canada. That's my opinion.
Are we at the same place in terms of on-the-ground organizing in Canada as the U.S.?
I think that... I will say this, is that I think that the disciplinariness, the sort of disciplinary social control in Canada, is a lot more insidious and a lot more intense in some ways. Because of a relatively, and this is generalization, higher standard of living than major cities in the United States. Again, like, this is relative and general. But I think what I, like, for instance, like, you know, we have a public health care system. The social security is generally higher than the United States, things like that. But I do think that from my experience and from what I've observed, there's a lot of organizing in Canada that focuses on performing dissent. And I think that's very important because of the facade that Canada has to the world. That's like a humanitarian peacekeeping, like, everyone is like happy schmappy here kind of thing. So I think it's very important to have these organized performances of dissent against the state. So, like, I mean, I really want to honor, like, our courageous comrades at the G20. So I think there's that. And then I think in the States, because of the neglect by the government of so many marginalized populations, people have had to organize in a different way to kind of, to, like, really win at governmental levels. Like, that there are folks visioning to take over school boards and municipal governments and, you know, legislative apparatus. So I think that that's also really important. Like, I mean, I think these are pieces of organizing, like, different emphases that need to speak to each other, because I really don't think you can you can focus on one and not on the other. And I think the states, I mean, they just have also more people, right? They have, like, 10 times more people than we do. So there's, like, a lot more... there's a broader variety of, like, what people are doing.
Right.
Well, but definitely a focus on organizing to win is something that I was really noticing there.
Right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Cynthia.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no, it was our pleasure. I've been speaking with Cynthia Oka. She is a community organizer with the Vancouver Status of Women and was one of the Canadians who attended the U.S. Social Forum in Detroit, Michigan. If you would like to find more information on the U.S. Social Forum, you can visit the official website at www.ussf2010.org.
Everyone is breaking out, covering the ground. I can only dream of. all go by from the corner of my eye, wondering what I'm made of and why I'm the first of the last to know. I'm coming out my for yourself. The books there on the shelf that I never got to, I bought them for the show so everyone would know that I belonged here too, while I just rehearsed what I hope to show. I'm coming out my way. I'm coming out my way. I'm coming out my
You're listening to CDSF 90.1 FM, and that was Peter Katz. This week, millions of Torontonians had their lives interrupted by the largest security operation this country has ever seen. While some seized the opportunity to show their dissent by smashing corporate storefronts in downtown Toronto, numerous peaceful protesters were prevented from exercising their right to freely express their opinions and concerns. Over 800 people were arrested, and many more were harassed and beaten by the police. The G8 and G20 summits are now over, but the struggle to release everyone from jail and restore justice is likely going to continue for a long time. Today on our show, we'll bring you a selection of stories from people who were on the ground in Toronto this weekend and who experienced the police insanity firsthand. First is Lorelai Krusha, who works in community development in Toronto. The recording is from last Thursday, June 24th, and was accessed on the John Bernard audio blog.
Hi, my name is Lara, and I'm here to tell you how I experienced the over-policing that's going on in our city right now. On Monday, June 21st, police falsely arrested, harassed, and intimidated me near a demonstration against the G8 and the G20. I was across from the park where a small group was gathered. Police cornered me, prevented me from entering my workplace, and wrongly charged me with possession of burglary tools. The burglary tools in question were my keys to my workplace. Police detained me and held me for several hours in the Toronto Film Studio, which has been converted into a temporary detention center. All the charges were dropped and I was released unconditionally when the detective on my case found out that the burglary tools I was charged with possessing were my keys.
Shame.
Shame. Shame.
I work in community development and children's gardening in the downtown core. I've never been arrested before. On Monday, I experienced firsthand the excessive police presence in Toronto in the lead up to the G8 and the G20. I was by myself. I was not at the rally when I was cornered by 10 or 12 police officers. They refused to listen to me when I explained that I was authorized to enter the building. To my knowledge, the police did not follow the usual Toronto police procedures during my arrest. For instance, the arresting officer was not present when my photo was taken, and I also noticed that personal information was removed from my cell phone without my knowledge or consent. Police targeted me, intimidated me, and fabricated charges against me because shortly before my arrest, I had provided one of the demonstrators with a thin bamboo pole from which to hang a flag. I witnessed the police throw the demonstrator on the ground to seize the bamboo flagpole. After that, a large group of police cornered me and arrested me on trumped-up charges. The flag in question is a symbol for Indigenous unity. This incident is not only about police intimidation and the excessive police presence during the G20, it's indicative of how Indigenous people are treated by the government and by police forces. I find it unbelievable that while World Cup soccer fans are parading through the city carrying all manner of flags, a Native person is not allowed to fly their flag on Native land.
Shame!
Even though the police were successful in scaring me, I decided to speak out against being falsely arrested. We need to speak out to stop the excessive policing and the overreacting of police during the G20 summits. I hope that people are not scared away from coming to fill the streets and raise our voices for justice. I hope to see all the flags of unity, all the Indigenous flags, all the rainbow flags, the black flags, and the pink flags flying in celebration. Thank you.
So that was Laura LaCruscia speaking at a rally in Toronto. Over the course of the weekend, the violence obviously escalated. Next, independent journalist Stefan Christophe will speak about his experience of police repression in Toronto. The interview, I should mention, was done by Drew Ojaje of the Toronto Media Co-op and is available on the Media Co-op's website.
So, Stefan Christophe, can you tell me what you saw earlier today at the detention center?
Hundreds of people gathered in a park close to where all the prisoners from the G8 protest gathered. We marched together down the streets, clapping our hands, chanting, "Free our prisoners." After marching for some time, we gathered in front of them. There was a man who was playing music. He had a guitar. There was chanting. We simply stood there to show our solidarity with the over 300 people arrested during the protests, ongoing protests against the G20. When we were sitting down, and some people standing, chanting, police very quickly moved in on the protest outside of the jail where the protesters are being held, and moved in with batons. There was undercover agents present, very quickly came out of the crowd and began hitting people with their batons, pushed the crowd back. People regathered themselves and continued to protest. And at that point, we thought it would be over. But what happened then was the police, when they kept on moving towards the crowd, they sent in officers to grab those who had been most vocal at the protest in opposition to the first hit from the police. And at that point, the protest dispersed.
Is anyone left at the detention center now?
From my impression, most people ran from the corner. There's those who are still in the detention center, and they've actually arrested some people who were at the protest to support the other protesters who had been jailed, to be in solidarity with them outside of the center, to chant and hope that they hear them within the prison walls. But the other thing I'd note about the protest was the police used tear gas against this gathering in solidarity with the arrestees from the G20 mobilization here in Toronto. They fired tear gas directly into the crowd. Quickly, officers came out with huge guns to fire tear gas, and at that point, gas was everywhere. The undercover agents were running into the crowd with their batons, and people essentially ran through the streets. It was a residential neighborhood. People had come out of their homes on that particular street and seemed also very upset about what had happened. Everybody was quite shocked. And, you know, this was a rally to support, very simply, those who had been arrested and to show our solidarity. But what happened was that another wave of repression happened, and it happened very quickly. And it's very clear that those who were targeted for the rest were tackled, dragged on the ground. People were batoned. People were tear gassed.
We've heard reports of the use of rubber bullets. Can you confirm that?
I can't confirm that. I heard the sounds of gunshots. At that point, police had pointed at me, and I was rushed away by a bunch of activists from Toronto very quickly. I'm very thankful of that. At that point, they were running into the protests, and I was leaving as quickly as possible. But I can confirm that I definitely heard gunshots, and they used tear gas. That's what I can confirm. I don't know what those gunshots were, but the fact is they were using chemical weapons against mainly a protest that had been sitting on the ground. There was a young protester who was playing bass guitar and singing chants, free the prisoners, what do we want, freedom, when do we want it now, and calling for a release of all those who chose to dissent against the G20 in Fortress Toronto.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, just that the arrests are ongoing, and they're targeting many, many people. And I hope that people keep abreast of the situation, and we should obviously be there also this afternoon when those who were arrested yesterday will appear in court.
Thanks for your report, Stefan.
Of course, Drew.
So, Stefan Christoph talked about police repressions at the Jail Solidarity Rally yesterday. Next up, we're going to hear some more witnesses from this rally. They were pre-recorded by Christiania of the Toronto Media Co-op before the police attacked the protesters.
A peaceful protest by allies and supporters of activists detained during G20 demonstrations held outside of an East Toronto detention facility was brutally attacked by plainclothes and uniformed police officers on Sunday afternoon. At 11 a.m., about 100 people and more than a dozen journalists gathered in Jimmy Simpson Park, where organizers of the demonstration negotiated with police for an escorted peaceful march along several blocks leading to the detention center.
We will not try to take the road. We will not try to cross the street. There will be bicycle cops escorting us. We ask that in the event of a disperse, if they ask us to disperse, that people leave calmly, that people walk, and that people leave in groups, that you do not leave individually. And that is for safety.
People present expressed their varied reasons for supporting activists detained during G20 events.
Well, I'm Danielle Wren, so I'm from Philadelphia. And I actually was at the U.S. Social Forum in Detroit last week. So I came from there to here. I have a long history of organizing with folks in Toronto, with OCAP. I've been working with them for years, so just coming out to support them. Well, I'm here as a legal observer, so I have my hat on. So I've been doing legal observing for a long time, so I was here to play that role. It seems like particularly with the arrest last night, and also the targeting of organizers, particularly organizers of color, from No One Is Illegal, is just really troubling, and just, you know, what that does to organizing, how that kind of scares people out of being leaders and doing effective work. So, I think it's good that people are out here supporting those folks. So.
My name's Charles Van Vliet, trade unionist. I'm here because people shouldn't be arrested for, saying what they believe. I think this is turning into a little bit of a police state. I don't like the G8 and G20. I don't like what they're doing to this planet, particularly now that we got a 13-month-old. They're not doing crap for him. They're doing it for themselves. So I'm a little angry and a little frustrated what's going on.
My name is Alex Murphy, and my partner was a legal observer at the Novotel Hotel. And him and about 100 other people were arrested there. I was also detained in this area for a long time, but the police eventually let a few people go, and they let us go. I don't know why. I just think it's important for them to know that we're outside, and even though the police will pick off certain people, we won't be divided by the people that they choose to arrest.
I'm John Muir, and I'm here basically because I think The arrests were a little bit outrageous. From what I've seen on the media, there was two cruisers that got burned and 400 people arrested. It doesn't make any sense to me. I think somebody's taken the occasion to do a certain restriction on demonstration and protesting, which is not good. This is Canada, so we have a right to protest. And that's the only right we got with leaders that don't listen.
At the detention facility, a film studio converted to hold detained and arrested protesters, the crowd assembled across the street, cheering and singing. Three of those held inside were released to cheers from supporters. However, only minutes later, and under the watch of numerous film and video cameras, a white van pulled up to the scene, and ununiformed, plainclothes officers ran out of the vehicle and into the crowd, shoving people aside to target several individuals for arrest. Almost immediately, the police line moved in, with lowered helmets and batons flying. Rubber bullets were shot into the crowd as protesters fled the scene frantically and in tears.
I saw something I've just never seen before. A bunch of undercover cops hopped out of vans and started running through the crowd, pushing people. And then the police line advanced and people came out with batons. That was really freaky.
Activists made an effort to regroup, but were forced to disperse by police intimidation as an emergency task force vehicle and dozens more riot police arrived on the scene.
Demonstration I've ever seen, like no graffitis, nothing, absolutely nothing.
That's stupid.
That was scary.
Yeah, just when the man started to spoke like about the event of yesterday, and that is truly what happened. And the majority of speaking is.
So that was a clip from the Jail Solidarity Rally that took place yesterday in Toronto. Next, we will hear from Dan Hamilton, an 18-year-old man who just moved to Toronto. He was interviewed by Rabble TV shortly after he was released after having spent 26 hours in a small police cage.
I was arrested at the Nortel riot. I was just a bystander just walking by, and I noticed that there was a riot. So I just was standing by watching the riot, and then they were just closing in, so I decided this is getting a little too much. So I was on my way to leave. As I was walking by, the riot team attacked me and were like, "You can't leave. You can't leave here. You chose to be here. We gave you a chance to leave." I'm like, "I didn't hear a single chance to leave, and nor did anybody here. And this is my first day even living in this town. Can I please leave?" And they just pushed me out of the way and said, "Do you want to make me use this on all of you?" And she had a tear gas gun in her hand. So I just continued and sat down with everybody. They just kept swarming in, and then just decided to announce, "We're arresting all of you. You had the chance to leave. We gave you a chance. You're done. You're gone." And they just arrested all of us, put us on coach buses, and brought us here. There was media outside waiting. They didn't even have the nerve to show anything. They drove us right inside, closed the doors, and then let everybody out.
Can you tell me a little bit the conditions inside?
Inside, everything is just disgusting. There's no garbage pails. Anything that's gave to us is just thrown on the ground, like anywhere. Sandwiches. The only thing we really got was like a little Dixie cup of water twice a day, and it was like lukewarm. And we also got a sugar-free, like little same thing of lukewarm Tang. And we would get two sandwiches a day with just a piece of cheese on it. All we got every day. And the lights were on 24 hours, so nobody really got any sleep. The first pen that we were in has an outhouse with no door, and there's 40 people in this little room when there's only supposed to be a maximum of 15. It was just ridiculous.
How long were you inside for?
I was inside for about 26 hours, I guess. At the 24th hour, I demanded that I would to be released because that was my rights, and they assured me that my rights didn't apply in that building. And
why? What did they justify?
That's all they said. They're like, sometimes your rights just don't apply here. So I'm like, oh, I'm pretty sure they apply everywhere, but if that's what you want to think. So after I was released, they were describing how we would have to go into like a holding cell. And then I mentioned my boyfriend, and he said, oh, you are a part of the gay community, are you not? I'm like, yes. And he's like, well, the people in here don't really take too kind to your type, so I recommend you act straight during your visit here, and once you leave, you can act the way you choose. And then just kept going on. He's like, actually, I'm going to put you and your boyfriend in a segregated room. And it was just a little stall. Like, it looked like a dog pen. And there was a whole line of just gay people in these, like, one-person things. There was, like, a lesbian couple. There was me and my boyfriend. And then there was two separate lesbians that were just put there just because they were gay. But they didn't admit that. But they were put there for their own safety. Like, the entire group was not homophobic whatsoever. The only people who were homophobic in that building were the police. Like, everybody else was so peaceful and kind and loving towards everything, but they were the only ones who were even offending everybody.
Have they said that they're going to charge you with anything?
No, they didn't charge me with anything. They just let it off as a breach of... a disturbing of the peace, but we got let off with no charges. But some people were charged, but I don't know what they were charged with, but I wasn't charged.
Did you have to sign anything?
No, nothing, which was really strange considering they had like portfolios of our information. They took at least 3 pictures while we were there of us and kept them in these folders, but when we were detained, they never gave us any information whatsoever, just our personal belongings.
Were you allowed to call anyone?
Yes, we were allowed to make one phone call at least, and pretty much everybody called this lawyer for the class action lawsuit, so it should be pretty sweet.
Okay. Thanks so much.
No problem.
Can you just spell your name?
DanHamilton.
So that wraps up our section on the police crackdown in Toronto. For more information and updates on the situation, visit 2010.mediacoop.ca or toronto.mediacoop.ca.
And that wraps up our show for today. You've been listening to a show that we're calling for now, Worm's Eye View, News from the Grassroots. This show is a group effort. Today it's me, Peter, and Maria, but we always welcome new volunteers.
Yeah, so next will be a song called Welcome to Toronto by DJ Trishna. And an interesting fact about that song, the spoken word that you will hear is actually from an opening speech at the Convergence.
And you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
Democracy shirking, fear-mongering, women's rights abusing Stephen Harper invites us all to watch rich people talk to rich people about how to save the world from rich people. This June, the G8-G20 circus is coming to town. Once again, billions will be spent so that politicians, lawyers, and big businessmen can assure us that the world is in safe hands. Like a song for Haiti, we'll be told that the few can be many. From the 21st to the 27th of June, the people of Toronto, Turtle Island, invite the whole world to sing a different song. Toronto, from Jane and Finch to Parkdale, Rexdale to Malvern, the inner colony run by the institutions of economy, where schools banish children, governments banish schools, employers degrade and profit from the exploitation of women, migrant workers bleed. they try. Indigenous people pushed aside, humiliated by laws that line the pockets of the wealthy under their corporate sky. Welcome to Toronto, where the welfare line grows almost as quick as a gap between the rich and the poor, where a welfare check won't get you a roof, let alone food. Welcome to our streets, $3 from A to B. They will deny disability because time waits for nobody. The city behind the tower, it ain't free. Welcome to the streets choked by big businesses, gut rot, where doctors of color work taxis, the factories, where women work the homes of the wealthy to try to keep their children healthy, to try and find opportunity in the land of the plenty on a belly starved empty. Welcome to urban apartheid. Streets partitioned by police, security, immigration officials, and CCTV. The city's paramilitary and their bedtime buddy, the TV, wage war on the homeless, the youth, the sex worker, the black male in the hoodie, the faces that make their label poverty. Welcome to streets where the GHG20 feeds, where their hatred economy breeds the knives that kill our children, the laws that pollute our food. Welcome to the fence streets, where the powers that be underestimate the powers of you and me, where we are rewriting the world's destiny, where in the cracks and the concrete we find sustenance. In the name of tomorrow, we return these streets to global family, to those who wish her free. In these streets, no one is illegal. Another world is possible, and it's here, and it's now, and it's a party. We don't need no song from no celebrity. We won't be sung to sleep. Their songs won't heal the world because we have our own words, our own flag, and it's unfurled. We are the people, we are the beat that run rings around capitalism's tyranny. Our world needs you. Let the GHG20 hear you. We are the many, you are the